Accession number 10165, reel number 31.
Martin McLean, reel 31. After your period at Bridlington, whenabouts was it you went up to Rillington?
Well, after Cromwell, that was when the invasion was imminent. We took a more serious view of training after that because we were confined to the sea front and confined defensive positions. Well, now invasion was no chance of invasion through the rough seas and things. The battalion and the whole division began a series of very hard exercises, training, marching, exercising, playing as soldiers right throughout Yorkshire. And for this, we were given mobile columns of vehicles supplied by Canadian troops. And these Canadians, the same Canadians always came to my company or my unit and provided the transport for runners all over Yorkshire, and we'd go through imitation attacks, like Driffield Aerodrome was very near at hand, and that was one of the favourite ones, whereby the enemy were attacking Driffield Aerodrome and we'd go in and repel invaders and clear the place off, and all sorts of...
How exactly were you meant to do that? How did you practice doing it?
We'd get there quickly and assess the situation. The command officer would assess the situation and send them in under ordinary movement and fire to clear the Germans out of the airfield altogether and the buildings. We weren't so very good at clearing the buildings in them days because we never had an opportunity, being peacetime soldiers, of actually going through buildings, going through houses, clearing up or throwing grenades into rooms and clearing up. But we practiced a little bit in these things, going through buildings and supposed to be shooting through windows. But now, as time went on, we know that was only infantile stuff. We wanted a lot more knowledge of clearing houses and streets. Anyway, that was one of our main things. And then we'd do a lot of marching, as I said, and exercising right throughout the whole of Yorkshire. It was shortly after the new year when a movement order came for us that we were selected as the mobile unit that had to be sent in to repel any breach in the defence of Bridlington and Yorkshire area. And so we were taken out the line. Another unit took over from us. And we were sent back to around Malton area. We were stationed at Company HQ, headquarter company, was stationed at a place called Rillington, which is about 4 mile or 5 mile outside of Malton. And all around in the wooded areas and the little villages stationed the rest of the companies.
What sort of billets did you have?
Well, in the main, we had just the tented accommodation, farmhouses, anything that was going, they put us in. Where there wasn't farmhouses, they put the men in tents. This was winter, they tried as much as possible to get the men inside, which in fact they did do in the main, get nearly everyone inside. They started erecting wooden huts for us because it was going to be a static place where they were going to hold a reserve of troops for such like repelling of invasion. So they started building these Nissen huts in Rillington for battalion headquarters. And it was the first time I'd seen them, but these round corrugated iron huts, very, very cold indeed. And that's how we lived. The men took them very well. They were out the cold, they were in the shelter, but getting fuel and coal to warm these places was another kettle of fish. And the steel walls amplified the cold outside. Although there was a double layer of corrugated iron inside these huts, it was still very, very cold in these billets because they had stone floors and a very small metal stove in the middle of the room, much like we had in peacetime. And that one stove was supposed to heat the whole of the room. Well, it wouldn't heat no more than 4 or 5 yards around it. The whole battalion was very much interested in this new role that we're playing at, and were kept very active at it. As I said, the Canadians supplied the transport, all brand new Bedford trucks, to convey us around on these practice rushing to different parts where the Germans had broke through on the beaches, on all over the shop. They made up exercise for us so that we were practicing. We always got the same driver and the same truck.
So you weren't using drivers from your own battalion. No. They were all supplied for you.
All transport in the battalion them days was a echelon. That was our battalion transport. And that was either to carry your arms and equipment, or to carry ammunition, or to carry the cooks and all the B echelon stuff. They had no vehicles for to carry troops, so such as troop transporters.
And the only difference that you could see in the tactics were that you were being carried there in lorries, but then you
That's
fought.
Right.
You had the same
fighting
techniques.
We had to get out, and as soon as we approached the area where the breach through the defences had been, it was our job then to get out and shake out as a battalion and do the attack under the normal routine, under command of the commanding officer and company commanders and things of that nature. And so we practised this for quite some time. And it was while at Rillington we made some very good friends. The local villagers were welcomed us no end at all. And at this time also, it was decided that in view of the fact that there was no chance of invasion, that married men could bring their wives if they could get accommodation for them by the villagers in Rillington and all the other places, they could have their wives staying with them. Well, I was lucky enough I had my wife staying with me, but I still had to attend to all my duties. There was no skiving off. It was only when I was free did I manage to go and see the wife and daughter. And it was at this time that I got posted to a company called A Company, because I told you before that now the mortar platoon is now taken over by an officer, and they didn't want PSMs, platoon sergeant majors. I was promoted to company sergeant and sent off to A Company, and that was just outside of Rillington, and I used to walk along there each day and back when I came for to be home with the wife, and sometimes I had to stay in the billets because we're going on early exercises.
What were your different responsibilities? I mean, you've told us about your responsibilities as PSM. What were your different or responsibilities as CSM? How did it differ, your role?
Well, the role, in my opinion, was lesser, much lesser. A company sergeant major is responsible for keeping the nominal role of the company and for drill and discipline of the company, which, where the men are scattered in such a degree in different billets, you had little control over unless you got them together at some very, very rare occasion to give them drill. But we seem to forget drill on these occasions. But a sergeant major is responsible for drill and discipline and maintaining the nominal role of the company and maintaining working parties and seeing that things were run as a company should run.
What does that involve, maintaining the nominal role? How did they go about that?
Well, that was very simple. Every man that comes in your company, you take all his particulars, his name and number, always the same thing, number, rank and name, and then his next of kin, and all particulars detailing as to what sort of training he had been committed to, what he had done at the depot, what he had done at any other unit he had been, so that we could know as to what standard of training the man had achieved. And from there on, pass him on the platoon with the information that would be gleaned from the man, and they in turn would place him into a section, maybe, if the man was well enough, you might even find he's up to second in command of a section. Because at this time we had an awful lot of national servicemen, and the young lads were just finding their feet as far as the army was concerned. They were keen enough and willing enough to do the work, but they lacked the experience. And so if we found an experienced man with a lot of experience, particular ex-regulars, they were roped in to either be section commanders or second in command of a section. We give them responsible jobs, and if they didn't fit in the job, we sharp took them out of it, because I wouldn't stand for any bullying of men. Never did, never will, nor I abhor reading in today's papers of what happened. Bullying to the extent of putting onto a man and keep shouting at them all the time, making the man's life unbearable in billets after he's finished his day's training. I reckon that when a man's finished his day's work, he should be allowed to rest the same as everybody else without being harassed by junior NCOs barking and shouting at them all the time.
When this nominal role, did you keep track of where people were when they went away from the unit on, say, training courses or anything like
yes.
that?
Yes. Oh, yes.
So you knew where everyone was?
When you had the company on the strength, you had a parade state. That's what we called them. You had a complete list of men that were in hospital, sick, men who had been in hospital for so long that were wirelisted. Once they were wirelisted, they were off your books. And the same with people who went on courses, you know exactly how long they were away for, where they'd gone to. And so these people maintained on your company strength all of the time. And every week we had to send in a nominal role, or not nominal role, a strength state to Battalion HQ, telling them exactly the state of the company in regards of numbers of people. And if we run down on numbers, they'd make us up with reinforcements.
Now, you had you were also drill and discipline, you said. You mentioned the way you thought the discipline and the junior NCOs should behave and how you supervised that. Did you find, with the unit being separated and there not being much drill, that the standards declined in any way in A Company, you know, with it all being separated out in different billets?
Now, you asked me a funny question there, because I wasn't aware of what A Company could do until I went there. I don't know their standard drill or anything of that nature. I took them over from a sergeant major who'd taken ill and gone off. And I took them over and I had to accept them as they are. What state they were, I couldn't tell you until I got them together on a drill. And they were pretty hopeless, because we had a lot of sergeant majors coming in and sergeants coming in from the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, from other regiments as reservists. And they'd be seconded to us, but they didn't know light infantry drill. They knew their own heavy infantry drill, but we had our own special type brand of drill, being light infantry men. And the first opportunities I got, I used to take the company on drill parade along the road, just beside the company headquarters. But that was a very rare occasion, and you couldn't get them, because these days, the command officer and the company commanders insisted that their platoon commanders, that's the officers, control the men of the whole of the day on their training, supervise it and everything. Well, I didn't do much training in that way, but as I say, my job was to maintain the nominal role, the drill, the discipline of the company. Anything I saw going wrong, have the man up before the company commander for a choking up.
Wasn't much in discipline. Did you have to have many people before the...
Oh, yes. In the initial stages, people had gone absent, people being laid back off leave. They were going on leave now. And there's always reasons to train late or something, but they always had to be taken up and made an example of, punished, given defaulters. Now, defaulters is something which, in the modern army, they just don't do. They fine a man. A man is taken before the the company commander on a minor charge, and the company commander can punish the man up to 7 days CB. But over 7 days CB, now CB means confined to barracks, means that he does all the dirty chores and does all work all during his spare time. He has no free time for the whole of the 7 days that he's on this defaulter scheme. He's given extra drill if there's no work for him to do, but there's always jobs for him to do, and them to do, I should say. Now, over seven... Now, that was known as a company report. If a man had more than 7 days, if they thought... The company commander thought the charge warranted more than 7 days, he's sent him before the commanding officer. And there the commanding officer may give the man punishment, field punishment. Field punishment would be carried out at battalion headquarters under the supervision of the provost sergeant, where they were given all menial tasks and read to double up and live together in one hut, and treat like a detention centre. Or, again, if it became a more serious charge, the man would have to go for a court-martial. So that is the type of discipline which was maintained in them days, and it was very strict. You'd have a man maybe an hour late getting back to billets from being on leave, and you've got to reckon up that the man may live up in Scotland. He's got to come down to York, get from York to Malton, get from Malton, where the buses are all stopped, get from Malton to his billet area, and sometimes he'd have 10 or maybe more miles to walk. He may be late, but he's still punished, because they insisted that the man had to be there at the time stated.
So that was the discipline side. Now, you had to you controlled the working parties. What sort of jobs were they on at that time?
Well, the working parties that we had for defaulters. Now, the working parties for men, no, because they were always engaged in training on their training hours. The only ones who worked off this time was the defaulters, and they were you'd make pathways, roadways, dig trenches, clear up the area of litter, scrub the office out, scrub the floor, scrub the tables, and clean up the officer's mess. all these sort of menial jobs would find for them to do, and they'd have to do it under supervision of an NCO. So, really speaking, once my back was turned, I'm quite sure some of the NCOs were quite lenient with the men, having a lot of sympathy for them.
How did you spend your day then? What was the sort of routine of it at that, at Rillington?
Well, it was much the same as the, I'd say, individual training and peacetime. When we got the men together at Rillington, at just outside of Rillington, the officers, some of them quite new to the men, got to know the men by putting them on individual training, like under supervision of the sergeant, maybe a bit drill, maybe a bit weapon training,
and where were
maybe
you
a bit discussion
that?
In the office with the company commander. As I say, I didn't have as much to do when I was the mortar platoon commander. I had much more to do. I found it was a bit of a boring job, sergeant major. One of the most important jobs, as they termed it, was looking after the company's ammunition. You'd get your ammunition from battalion headquarters, and it was the reserve ammunition plus all ammunition appertaining to 2-inch mortars, grenades, smoke grenades, sticky grenades, 303 by the boxes, and you carried them round wherever you went. For instance, we moved as a mobile column and the attack somewhere, we'd have to take that ammunition with us. And then when it wasn't in use, it had to be put underground in a safe place so that nobody would sort of interfere with it and it would blow up and injure anybody, but always had to be put underground. That was my main job, just handling the ammunition and looking after the company office. And the company office had the runners, and a runner for each platoon, and also a company clerk. In the back of the hut was the CQMS and the company storeman. They built up the whole of the company. We had a captain who had been a corporal in the horse guards, and he'd been promoted to captain and took over company commander. And then we got other different officers.
Do you remember
officers.
His name?
Yeah, forget it for the time being.
Okay.
But one of the officers is still alive today, was one of the platoon commanders, a fellow called Rome, Major Rome, MC. He went right through the war with us. The others, the second in command was a young man called Lockhart. He got killed in Kohima. I do forget the others because I'm getting older now and I forget the names of them.
This
Hungate. Hungate was the name of the company commander.
Was Hungate? He'd been a corporal. How did you find him as a ranker officer? Did it make any difference to you?
Well, I found that I don't want to belittle officers too much because it may feel that I am opposed to them. I was, as I said in the first instance, I got me back up about officers. I had a bust up with this company commander in no uncertain terms. Should I talk about it or should I not?
Well, yes, we'd like to know.
Well, there was three very tall officers, and Captain Hungate was a tall officer. And they got on very well together. And they used to come in the company office and talk about their exploits that night, or where they'd been that night, because we're free. Once training was finished, they could go wherever they want. And they were getting up to a certain pub away up in the area. I don't know where it was. I'd never been there. And one of them was chasing after the barmaid, of course, and they were getting well on, and they were sitting and talk about what happened over the night and where they'd been and what had happened. And they didn't get on with the training of the platoons where they should have been. Well, we got one small officer posted to us. I can't remember his name, but as soon as he put his nose in the company office, Captain Hunt got to say, "What's your platoon on, Mr. So-and-so? They're on field training, sir. They're on weapons, they're on this, that and the other. Well, you go and see to your train, your platoon." And these other officers were all sitting around with cups of tea that we had, the company clerk would get provided from the cookhouse, because we had a cookhouse near at hand, sitting talking about what had happened overnight. Well, I thought this was wrong. So I considered it was important that every man get to know every man in his company, and every man, and including officers, to do training as much as possible. Don't forget, these officers weren't fully trained. They were, I don't know where they came from. They may have been called up. They might have been to Octu, I don't know. But I thought that these officers should be with the men. So one day I got a bit annoyed off when I saw this young officer come in. He'd been with his platoon, and he came into the office, and he never even got himself a cup of tea when the company commander says, "Where's your platoon, Mr. So-and-so?" "Well, you go and see them, and damn well stay with them." So when he went out, I rounded up on the company commander and the officers. I said, "Sir, isn't it time that you sent these officers out to look after the men as well? It's important that they know the men and their training, and they'll never know the abilities of the men and pick out the best of the men if they are sitting here in this office." So instantly, the company commander cleared the office and chased them off to their platoons and gave me a right rollicking, which I expected. Have no doubt, I expected, but I spoke my mind. And from there on, the officers didn't have their get-togethers. If they did, it was away from the officers' mess. I said, another thing that I'd object to this for is, I said, you've got the stores through there next door, through that thin partition. You've got the company runners. You've got the company clerk here. And all listening agog to what you're talking about. And I said, that's not good for discipline. You're talking about things that they are forbidden to do. And so I think you should curtail your talks to elsewhere. Well, from there on, Captain Hungett and I never got on very well, I must say. But I'd done my job and he couldn't get me for anything. So as time went on, we had done all this training in Rillington. It was much the same, mobile exercises, off-weight practising, breaches in defence, attack an enemy that had landed by a parachute somewhere, all mimic things that put some enemy out to represent the paratroopers, and it was our job to rout them out and capture them or shoot them up and take the positions. It was getting on, we'd been there about a year at Rillington. It was rather a boring time. I was once again being roped in for training of Home Guard.
Did you get sent to any courses during that year?
No, not me. I was considered fully trained. I had my 3-inch qualifications. I had lots of qualifications. But they used to still rope me in for to take the Home Guard. And it was once I went off to take them at a village called Pickering. And when I went to this Pickering, I assumed the same job as I did before. There were a new unit forming, and I took all the weapons that I could lay my hands on, Bren guns, rifles, 2-inch mortars, grenades, sticky grenades, and all that sort of thing. I didn't take 3-inch mortar because I was now no longer with the 3-inch mortar platoon, but I took all infantry weapons on a truck, and off I went to Pickering with intent to take them on, showing them the type of weapon they would use. And all probably now being Home Guard, they'd get the same sort of stuff to deal with. A fat person came up to me, very plump, very florid face, obviously an ex-major. Don't ask me why. It was the old type of country farmer man, but he looked like an ex-officer. And he came up to me, he said, "I am Major so-and-so." He said, "Now, before you start taking these men on anything, I want you to teach them to salute." I said, "Sir, invasion is imminent." And I said, I'm here for teaching men weapons, not drill. And so I said, "I refuse, sir, if you don't mind me saying so, to take your men on drill when it's more important to learn weapons. I was sent to take them on weapon training, and that's what I intend doing, sir." So we had a row. And it was obvious he wanted his men to be taught to salute so they could salute them as they passed them in the streets. That was my opinion. So I packed my kit and went back to the units. Next day I was sent for by the commanding officer because I'd been reported and asked me to give an explanation of my actions. And I told him the reason why. I said, "My opinion, sir, is this, that the men should be trained for war. As we know, invasion is imminent at any time. And these men should know their infantry weapons. And that's what I went along to instruct, as per my instructions, take them on weapon training. But when I was told to take them on drill, I objected to take them on drill when the unit was just forming. I said they didn't even have uniform. They were in civilians with a Home Guard badge on." He said, "Right, Sergeant Major, off you go, you'll hear no more about it." So I never got sent to Pickering anymore.
You still felt there was a danger of invasion in 42 then?
Yes. Oh, yes.
The winter had died.
Well, the thing was this. We had so much imbued into us that there could be an invasion. even though we'd heard the barges had been washed up and washed away, there's always the chances of airborne assault. So invasion was always imminent in our mind. We were still practicing right up to leaving Rillington on the same roll. So it must have been there. The threat must have been there. Whilst we're at Rillington, we're called up one day and told that the battalion had to pack up. We're going to leave Rillington and join a new division. And this division was a new division foreman down in Bury St. Edmunds. And it was the 42nd Division. And we were to join 127 Infantry Brigade. And we were to be trained as a mechanised unit in support of tanks.
So this is the start of 43, early
42. We went overseas in 42.
Sorry, yes.
So this is the end, about the end of 41 and beginning of 42. I can't exactly remember when we moved. And so we were delegated for this new job, and we packed up and went off to by train off to Bury St. Edmunds and landed up there in a huge meadow, beautiful place, you know. You've got to see these places. Well, a lot of you people will know Bury St. Edmunds, where we were, was a beautiful, beautiful area. As compared to the moors and things that we'd been used with in Yorkshire, that was a nice place. But Bury St. Edmunds, the grass seemed lusher and the trees seemed greener. So it must have been the spring when we went down there, because everything looked so nice. And we were in tents, were shoved in fields, and everybody was in tents, because there's no billets built there in this place where we were. It was a new brigade, new division foreman, a new brigade foreman as well.
Had your wife gone back to Newcastle?
Yes, all the wives had gone then. All the wives had gone some time before that, I think. Especially during the heavy training season, we're never at home. We're never in the area. We're always off exercising. We got settled in these camps, and it's then that I run foul of my company commander again. The grass, it was heavy lawns, heavy grass fields where the cattle used to feed on, and the grass was about knee high. And we had so little to do, because we're now taking these aptitude tests for placing people in correct positions for driving the vehicles and all this sort of thing. Now, the remarkable thing about these aptitude tests, I had one man in my company, Davis, and he was absolute horror. He was dirty, he was filthy, he was slovenly, he was always in trouble, always under folders. Not with me, but Battalion HQ and his company, he was always in trouble with the military law. And he turned out to have the most brilliant aptitude test of the whole battalion. That's everybody. And we were amazed at it. As a matter of fact, the man left the battalion on another job. I think the battalion was glad to get rid of him when it suggested he went. Never heard no more of him. And so we're busy on this aptitude test, and we're grading men.
Why would that be? Was he hiding his light under a bushel, or was it?
I think he was an educated man who didn't like the idea of being in the infantry. I used to get on well with him, but, I used to have to rollick him about his untidiness, his dirtiness, which all sandwiches, you know, you want a good turnout from your men, because the command officer sees a dirty man, you're the man to blame for it, you know. During this period, the company commander decided to have a drill parade. Now, as I said, a sandwich's response for drill, and I hadn't had much opportunity for a company drill together, because they're scattered round in various platoon localities. So it was a company sandwich's drill parade. Now, that means in a regular sergeant major's law, or the ex-regular army law, that only the sergeant major will drill that platoon, that company, or their men. No one else to interfere. If they want an officer's parade, he asks for a company commander's drill parade. And it's the same with the command officer. It becomes a command officer's drill parade if he wants the battalion. So on this occasion, it was put on company detail, a company sergeant major's drill parade. Well, I was going to take it easy with the men, because they can't march on a meadow that's knee-high in grass without having some sort of stumbling, and they wouldn't be able to kick the heels on the bottom. First of all, to make a drill pattern, you must get the ground hardened where the men have got to march. So the intention was to march them back and forward to trample down the grass and make the place where we intended to do our drill a much more drill-like area. And that was the only means of doing it, making the men walk up and down, march up and down to do it. Fell the men in and I started to march them off. And just as I got them started off, on came all of the officers, including the company commander, of the company. The men were labouring, marching in this thing. They had the platoon sergeant shouting at them, me shouting at them, and then the company commander started shouting at them, and the four officers started shouting at them, or five officers at ten. So the men were surrounded by people berating them and shouting at them, and I got